Good morning, this is your Sun Sounds of Arizona volunteer broadcaster, Cicely Tiernan, with today's Wall Street Journal. Careers. Inside the $10,000 job search, career coaching, LinkedIn fees, resume help. The costs of finding work climb as job hunts stretch over months. It's trying to be louder than anyone else, by Lindsay Ellis. It takes a lot of money to make money, especially when it comes to looking for a job these days. Josh Morgan, 45 years old, was laid off from his senior finance role late last year. After several fruitless months of searching for a new one, he paid a company about $10,000 for 6 months' help. The firm provides weekly meetings with a career strategist to evaluate open roles and sources potential jobs from talent recruiters. It also created a personal website for Morgan and lets him use software that helps tailor his resume to job descriptions. They're like a marketing company, and I'm the product, said Morgan, who lives in Greensboro, North Carolina. He is still looking for work, but says the price will be worth it if it helps him land a job faster. I'm in a fortunate position to be able to help to do it. Two converging forces are driving up the cost of finding a job for many Americans. One is the exploding cottage industry of networking and job search subscriptions, career coaching services, and artificial intelligence tools, all capitalizing on job seekers' frustrations and a stalled hiring market. The other is the growing length of the average job search as companies slow recruiting and leave positions unfilled. It now takes the average worker 24 weeks to find a job after losing one, nearly a month longer than a year ago, according to federal data for July. And the number of long-term unemployed is rising. The longer people have to pound the pavement looking for work, the more the costs climb. I wasn't anticipating this much of an investment, said 28-year-old Kyle Talley, a former audio technician who started looking for a job in coding or cybersecurity last year. Talley has since spent more than $200 on LinkedIn Premium for networking and about $900 on coding classes to show employers he is up to speed on the latest tech. He paid $50 for a career coach and more than $700 for paid AI tools like Grok and ChatGPT Plus to improve his resume and sharpen his coding skills. Another $500 went towards study materials for certifications that mentors and professors said were must-haves to land work. What Talley has shelled out for the job hunt doesn't count everything he has invested in training for a new career. He spent $17,000 last year for an 8-month coding boot camp and now plans to attend college for cybersecurity. James Finley, a software engineer in Glen Carbon, Illinois, became so frustrated from 3 months of searching that he explored putting his website URL on a digital billboard for $100 a week. He nixed the plan after getting a job offer last week. It's trying to be louder than anyone else, said Finley, 39. What gets results? Spending money on LinkedIn Premium, where connections can help users find someone on the inside, has a pretty big ROI, return on investment, said Edward Volsing, founder of Rivet Group, a recruiting firm in the Charlotte, North Carolina area. Connections are helpful in a stagnant market, where applicants can average 100 applications for every interview, he said. Marcia Tatiana, a 47-year-old product designer, employed such a strategy before landing a contract role in July. She spent several hundred dollars over 3 months of job hunting. In addition to LinkedIn Premium, she paid about $80 for FlexJobs, a remote work database. She subscribed to Teal, a job site that suggests positions and recommends resume changes, for about $80. Plus, there's Claude, Anthropot's artificial intelligence assistant, at $20 a month, which she calls a game changer for interview preparation. Yet there's no guarantee of all the expenditures and hustles will get results. Looking for a business or engineering internships, Miali Jackie, a 26-year-old graduate student, has been traveling to networking events. In the process, she has spent more than $1,000 on conference registrations and lodging, plus transit and food, and about $75 to join national associations for mentorship. Jackie briefly had an internship offer last summer, but had to keep looking when the program was canceled. Some of her costs come from not wanting to miss any opportunity. After an unexpected flight delay in Dallas, Jackie bought a $50 networking outfit from TJ Maxx, then drove to corporate office suites, distributing her resume without success. She is now gearing up to find a full-time job after her November graduation and budgeting $200 to travel to an August networking event in San Antonio. "I'm not sure what else to do, what other resources I haven't thought of," said Jackie, who lives in West Monroe, Louisiana. "Sometimes it's the least expensive moves that yield results." Andrew Yates, 43, tried for 10 years to break into the human resources field without success. He took out $22,000 in loans to earn a master's in HR from Colorado Christian University to get an edge. Then he spent $225 to take a test through SHRM, an industry group, to get a certified professional designation. What ultimately worked? He mentioned to a man he met at the gym that he was job hunting, and his new workout buddy gave him a referral to his company. Yates got hired and moved to Dallas for the role. "That $20 monthly gym membership ended up paying dividends," he said. "I guess that was a job expense unknowingly." Exclusive policy. Trump administration considers longtime critic to lead Bureau of Labor Statistics. Officials are looking at E.J. Antonio, chief economist at the Conservative Heritage Foundation, among others, to head Jobs Data Agency by Brian Schwartz and Meredith McGraw. The Trump administration is interviewing candidates to lead the Bureau of Labor Statistics, including at least one longtime critic of the agency, according to a senior administration official. Administration officials are weighing candidates to take the job after President Trump fired the BLS commissioner earlier this month following the release of a weak jobs report. One of the people being interviewed is E.J. Antonio, the chief economist at the Heritage Foundation, who has long criticized the agency's approach to collecting jobs data. "The interview process will include talks with a variety of candidates and is ongoing," the official said. Trump has yet to announce who he will nominate to run the agency. A White House spokeswoman said President Trump has selected the best and brightest individuals to lead the federal government. He will announce the next BLS commissioner when he has made a decision. Antony didn't return requests for comment. The White House's interest in appointing a prominent critic speaks to the significant overhaul that Trump is looking to make at the agency. Antony has voiced concerns about revisions to the jobs data at BLS. "There are better ways to collect, process, and disseminate data. That is the task for the next BLS commissioner, and only consistent delivery of accurate data in a timely manner will rebuild the trust that has been lost over the last several years," Antony posted on X last week. Economists have expressed concern that the personnel changes Trump is enacting at the top of the agency could undermine faith in America's economic statistics. Antony's supporters include former Trump White House chief strategist Steve Bannon, who has pushed for Trump to have a MAGA ally the president trusts running BLS. Antony called for the removal of Erica McEntarfer as head of BLS on Bannon's show following the release of a weak July jobs report. Hours later, Trump ordered his team to fire her. E.J. Antony as the new head of Bureau of Labor Statistics, that's what we're pushing. He's the guy that almost single-handedly took it down by going through their numbers, Bannon said on his podcast. Exclusive technology. Intel CEO singled out by Trump to visit White House on Monday. Lip Bu-Tan is set to meet with the president, who last week called for Tan's removal, by Lauren Thomas. Intel CEO Lip Bu-Tan is set to visit the White House Monday after President Trump called for his removal last week over ties to Chinese businesses, according to people familiar with the matter. Tan is expected to have a wide-ranging conversation with Trump with the intent of explaining his personal and professional background, the people said. He could also propose ways that the government and Intel could work together, they said. Tan hopes to win Trump's approval by showing his commitment to the country and pledging the importance of keeping Intel's manufacturing capabilities as a national security issue, one of the people said. Trump has aggressively pushed U.S. companies to make changes ranging from easing the cost of tariffs to doing business with more conservatives and other political allies. Trump's singling out of Tan came the day after he exempted tech companies such as Apple from new tariffs on semiconductors on the condition they increase their investments in the U.S. The CEO of Intel is highly conflicted and must resign immediately. There is no other solution to this problem, Trump wrote in a post on Truth Social on Thursday. The post came a day after Senator Tom Cotton, Republican, Arkansas, published a letter he sent to Intel board chairman Frank Yeary expressing his concerns about Tan's China ties. Tan is Malaysian-born and later became an American citizen. Scrutiny of his business dealings appears to be tied to a recent development involving Cadence Design Systems, the company he led until 2021, as well as his venture capital firm's investments in Chinese companies. Cadence last week agreed to plead guilty and pay more than $140 million to resolve Justice Department charges for selling its chip design products to a Chinese military university. Tan took over as CEO of Intel in March, following the exit of Pat Gelsinger last year. Investors cheered Tan's arrival after Gelsinger had been unable to revive Intel's falling stock price. Given Tan's experience having turned around Cadence Design and his relationships across the tech industry. But the first few months of his tenure have been marked by a clash with some members of the board, including Yeary, over the company's strategy, the Wall Street Journal reported Thursday. Intel had already made plans to make significant U.S. investments under former President Joe Biden. It pledged to spend $100 billion over 5 years to bolster U.S. chip-making capacity as it became the biggest recipient of funding from Biden's CHIPS Act. Tan has been focused on reviving Intel's manufacturing operations. He has been aiming to find external customers for the foundry business that will help justify the massive expenses associated with such investments. As it stands, most of Intel's foundry revenues come from manufacturing its own chips. Late last month, Intel said it would further slow the construction of its large-scale semiconductor manufacturing plants in Ohio to better align with customer demand. The lack of progress there has frustrated politicians, including Senator Bernie Moreno, Republican, Ohio. Tan said in a message to Intel employees Thursday evening that the U.S. has been his home for more than 40 years and that Intel has engaged with the administration to ensure they have the facts. Over 40-plus years in the industry, I've built relationships around the world and across our diverse ecosystem, and I have always operated with the highest legal and ethical standards, he said. Middle East. Israel's new war plan includes fighting in Gaza's central refugee camps. The prime minister revealed the previously undisclosed objective amid pressure internationally and at home by Anat Pallad. Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu said the new war plan, approved by Israel's security cabinet, includes dismantling Hamas and Gaza's central refugee camps in addition to Gaza City, a broadening that comes as he faces criticism internationally for expanding the war and from the far right wing of his coalition for not going far enough. The new war plan was approved just ahead of the weekend. Netanyahu discussed the plans in a phone call Sunday with President Trump, Netanyahu's office said. An announcement by the prime minister's office had only mentioned that the military would prepare to take over Gaza City. Netanyahu revealed the previously undisclosed targeting of the central camps in comments to reporters Sunday. The more limited initial objectives announced last week after Netanyahu had touted a takeover of the entire Gaza Strip, were criticized by far-right Finance Minister Bezalel Smotrich as too incremental. They decided once again to do the same thing and head for a military campaign that doesn't aim for a decisive victory, but just pressuring Hamas to go for a partial hostage deal, Smotrich said in a video statement on Saturday. Unfortunately, for the first time since the start of the war, I feel I cannot stand behind this decision and back it, Smotrich said, adding that he had lost confidence that Netanyahu wanted to defeat Hamas. Israel also came under heavy pressure internationally over its decision to expand the war, as well as earlier moves that sharply restricted the flow of food into Gaza and pushed many Palestinians closer to starvation. Germany said last week that it would restrict arms sales to Israel, while European countries and the UK criticized the war plan. The Prime Minister's ruling coalition relies on the support of far-right lawmakers like Smotrich and National Security Minister Itamar Ben-Gvir. Netanyahu has led to balance their demands with the views of his military and pressure from international partners since the beginning of the war in Gaza, which was sparked by Hamas's deadly attack on Israel nearly 2 years ago. Last Thursday, Israel's security cabinet instructed the IDF to dismantle the remaining Hamas strongholds in Gaza City and the central camps, Netanyahu said, during a news conference for foreign journalists, referring to the acronym for the Israel's military. Netanyahu offered few details of the new plan or how the central camps would fit into it on Sunday. He said the military would evacuate the population before the assault to designated safe zones where they would be provided with humanitarian aid. He declined to provide a timeline for the operation, but said Israel hoped to complete it quickly so it could end the war. Israeli authorities say it will begin with the goal of seizing control of Gaza City, the biggest population center in the north of the Strip. Military analysts said it could play out over weeks or months, reflecting serious resource constraints that are likely to limit the pace and scope of military operations. Under the plan, hundreds of thousands of Palestinians face the prospect of further displacement and new rounds of deadly fighting. More than 60,000 people have been killed in Gaza during the war, according to Palestinian health authorities, who didn't say how many were combatants. Some analysts said Israel appears to hope the increased military pressure will bring Hamas back into the negotiating table on its terms and could pause the operation at any point. Israel said it currently controls up to 75% of the Gaza Strip. Around 2 million Gazans are crammed into Gaza City, the seaside tent encampment at Al-Mawasi, and the central camps. Invasion of those areas would squeeze the population to an ever-shrinking territory amid a worsening humanitarian crisis. The new plan will require the country to call up a large number of soldiers. The military already faces severe manpower strains, and reservists are exhausted from almost 2 years of war in Gaza, Syria, Lebanon, and the West Bank. Polls in Israel have shown for months that a large majority of the population, including right-wingers, support ending the Gaza war in exchange for freedom for the remaining hostages held by Hamas. Tens of thousands of Israelis took to the streets of Israel on Saturday to protest Netanyahu's expansion of the war in one of the largest anti-war demonstrations in recent months. Opinion commentary: Jeffrey Epstein and the trouble with federal grand juries. He and Ghislaine Maxwell were indicted based solely on the testimony of law enforcement officers, by Joel Cohen. The Justice Department acknowledged last month that not a single victim had testified before the grand juries that indicted the late Jeffrey Epstein and his associate Ghislaine Maxwell on federal charges related to sex trafficking and abuse. Only two non-victim witnesses testified: the Federal Bureau of Investigations case agent and a New York City police detective assigned to an FBI task force investigating child exploitation and human trafficking. More than a comment on these defendants, this is a warning about federal grand juries' rigor in general. Grand juries are often portrayed as a shield for the citizenry against unwarranted accusations, but the Epstein and Maxwell indictments show how little grand juries typically have to go on in handing up indictments. FBI agents and federal prosecutors undoubtedly interviewed many of Epstein's and Ms. Maxwell's alleged victims and were satisfied with the bona fides of their claimed victimizations. Yet the grand juries never sat in a room with these girls, by now women, to hear and assess their chilling abuse accounts. Before they voted to indict, the grand jurors never looked any alleged victims in the eye to assess their credibility, the hallmark of fact-finding. Presumably, the law enforcement officers who testified only read to the grand jury summaries of the accuser's testimony. Strange as this may sound, limiting witness testimony is prosecutorial practice in virtually every federal grand jury case. The calculated reason is that doing so allows prosecutors to indict without risking testimony from witnesses that might be inconsistent with what they previously told the investigators during office or home interviews. Otherwise, defense attorneys could use such inconsistencies to make these witnesses appear less credible at trial and possibly gain acquittals. The logic works whether the witness is testifying in a simple drug case, the biggest corruption case in America, or an investigation into the likes of Epstein. Prosecutors couldn't pull this off in many state grand juries. New York State, for example, requires non-heresy proof against the defendant before grand jurors can indict. An indictment from such courts is more indicative of the substantive evidence in a case. In federal cases, an indictment is only an accusation, yet it is sufficient to force the accused to trial. I don't intend to exonerate Epstein or Ms. Maxwell. In 2021, a federal trial jury convicted her on 5 of 6 counts, but Americans should understand how flawed federal grand jury indictments have become. Federal case law does underscore the prosecutors are obliged not to mislead grand juries about the shoddy merchandising you are getting, as the Second U.S. Circuit Court of Appeals wrote in U.S. v. Epsta, 1972. Grand juries must be told if they are receiving only hearsay testimony, and they can insist on testimony from the non-hearsay sources. But because no judge is ever present inside the grand jury room or will likely ever review the full transcript, the system essentially relies on the good faith of the grand jury's legal advisor, who happens to be the prosecutor seeking the indictment. Next time you hear of a federal grand jury indictment, remember what it really means. As the adage goes, a prosecutor can get a grand jury to indict a ham sandwich. That's especially true in the federal system. Mr. Cohn practices white-collar criminal defense law at Petrillo, Klein, and Boxster. He has served as a federal and New York State prosecutor and is author of Blindfolds Off, Judges on How They Decide. World. Ukraine and Europe counter Putin's ceasefire proposal. Kyiv and European powers offer their own blueprint for ending war after the Russian leader demanded territorial concessions by Bojan Pankovic and Yaroslav Trumfivov. European powers and Ukrainian responded to Vladimir Putin's ceasefire plan with a counterproposal that they say must serve as a framework so that coming talks between President Trump and the Russian leader can gain traction, according to European officials familiar with the talks. The European plan rejected a Russian proposal to trade European-held parts of the Donetsk region for a ceasefire. It was put forward in a meeting with top U.S. officials in England on Saturday. Russia hasn't made steps toward peace despite its talks with the U.S. Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky said Sunday in an address calling for U.S. sanctions against Russia's economy. Russia launched an aerial attack Sunday on Ukraine's southeastern city of Zaporizhia, where at least 19 people were injured after homes, a clinic, and a bus stop were hit, according to emergency services. Sanctions are needed, pressure is needed, he said. If Russia does not want to stop the war, then its economy must be stopped. A U.S. official said the meetings on Saturday made progress toward Trump's goal of ending the war in Ukraine. A European participant said the U.S. side reacted positively to the European plan. European leaders, including France's President Emmanuel Macron, Germany's Chancellor Friedrich Merz, and UK Prime Minister Keir Starmer, said in a joint statement after the meeting that a diplomatic end to the war must protect Ukraine and Europe's security interests. We are convinced that only an approach that combines active diplomacy, support to Ukraine, and pressure on the Russian Federation to end their illegal war can succeed, the European leaders wrote. European governments, including those of Britain, Germany, and France, as well as Ukraine, scrambled to respond to the peace proposal that came out of the past week's encounter between Putin and the U.S. Special Envoy Stephen Witkoff at the Kremlin. Following these talks, Trump let lapse his self-imposed deadline for imposing stiff secondary sanctions on Russia and agreed to a summit with Putin in Alaska on August 15th. The European aim is to draw a common red line together with Ukraine that European officials say must apply to any potential negotiation with Russia. The European proposal includes demands that a ceasefire take place before any other steps are taken. It also says that territory can be exchanged only in a reciprocal manner, meaning that if Ukraine pulls out of some regions, Russia must withdraw from others. Crucially, the European plan, which was presented to Vice President J.D. Vance, Secretary of State Marco Rubio, Trump's Ukraine envoy Keith Kellogg, and Witkoff, also stipulates that any territorial concession by Kyiv must be safeguarded by ironclad security guarantees, including potential NATO membership for Ukraine. Finland's President Alexander Stubb called Trump to present the European initiative on Saturday afternoon. Europe stands united with Ukraine, Stubb posted on social media. We will continue to work closely with President Trump and the United States. The meeting was an important step forward, he added. A fragile ceasefire would only serve the Russians, cementing their conquests and curbing Ukraine's chances to fight back, European Union Foreign Policy Chief Kaja Kallas said in a message to European officials after the meeting. The European plan was drafted and presented to the U.S. side by chief aides to European leaders. Vance was at the meeting, while most other U.S. officials attended via a video link. According to officials briefed on the proposal brought by Witkoff from Moscow, Putin has said he would agree to a ceasefire in exchange for Ukraine, handing over roughly one-third of the eastern Donetsk region that Kyiv still controls. The front line would be frozen elsewhere, including in the Zaporizhia and Kherson regions that Russia also claims as its own. Several European officials briefed on the Wednesday meeting with Witkoff noted that Putin didn't repeat his original more hardline position that Ukraine must be demilitarized and its government replaced, and that all of Kherson and Zaporizhia regions whose capitals are controlled by Ukraine should be ceded to Russia. Putin annexed those three regions and a fourth, Luhansk, which is nearly fully occupied by Moscow after sham referendums in 2022. Some of the European officials said Saturday that if Ukraine were to hand over the entire Donetsk region, Russia would have to withdraw from the occupied parts of Zaporizhia and Kherson in the south. The plan shocked Zelensky, who hasn't been invited to Alaska, and European leaders. He described it, following Saturday's conversation with the UK Starmer, as a plan to reduce everything to discussing the impossible, and said that Ukraine wouldn't give its land to anyone. Germany's Merz said in a TV interview on Sunday that European leaders hoped Zelensky would take part in the Alaska meeting as well. A senior aide to a European leader said it was regrettable that Putin managed to avert the punitive measures scheduled by Trump that would have severely hurt Russia's war economy and diminished its ability to escalate its invasion of Ukraine. Putin showed how vulnerable he was to U.S. pressure, and Trump must use his leverage, the official said. Any agreement Trump and Putin reached in Alaska wouldn't be worth much without the participation of European leaders, another senior European official said. In their meeting with Vance, European officials reiterated that the future of Ukraine can't be discussed without Ukraine. You are listening to the Wall Street Journal on Sun Sounds of Arizona. I'm your volunteer broadcaster, Cicely Tiernan. If you miss any part of this program, you can get it on demand on our website at sunsounds.org, then click on Broadcast Info and Audio. Now continuing on with our article. No matter what happens in Washington, Europe will continue providing Ukraine with weapons and funds, one senior European official said. Russia has been on the offensive for more than 2 years, and in that time conquered less than 1% of Ukrainian territory, much of it in the Donetsk region, while losing hundreds of thousands of troops in pitch fighting dominated by brutal drone warfare. Embroiled in battles for the towns of Pokrovsk and Chasiv Yar since early last year, the Russian army is unlikely to seize the heavily fortified agglomerations of Slovyansk and Kramatorsk in the north of the Donetsk region anytime soon, according to most military analysts. Handing over the strategic terrain, home to hundreds of thousands of Ukrainian citizens, in exchange for a ceasefire would mean that Putin, who has broken multiple ceasefires in the past, would be getting a windfall in exchange for giving nothing, said European officials from three countries involved in the talks. The European counterproposal comes after a week of frantic diplomacy triggered by Putin's overture to Witkoff. Hours after the two men met at the Kremlin, Trump summoned a call with select European leaders and Zelensky to brief them on the proposal. On the call, Trump suggested that Russia would be ready to withdraw from the southern region of Zaporizhia and Kherson in exchange for full control of Donetsk, according to European officials from three countries familiar with that conversation and two subsequent calls. However, Witkoff walked back that claim the next day in a call with the chief aides of European leaders, suggesting that Russia would both withdraw and freeze the front line. On Friday, European officials demanded a third call with Witkoff to clarify the confusion about what Putin had proposed. In that call, Witkoff said that the only offer on the table was for Ukraine to withdraw unilaterally from Donetsk in exchange for a ceasefire. That proposal was rejected by both Zelensky and European officials involved in the talks. Opinion letters. Scrapping AI export controls is self-defeating. The policy was never intended as a brick wall, but as a strategic speed bump to limit China's military capabilities. Aaron Ginn's op-ed, ChinaZ.AI and America's Self-Defeating AI Strategy, mischaracterizes the purpose and effectiveness of export controls. The policy was never intended as a brick wall, but as a strategic speed bump, one essential tool among many for maintaining America's lead in artificial intelligence while limiting China's military capabilities. The controls on NVIDIA's H200 chips appears to have been working until CEO Jensen Huang's lobbying secured a reversal that handed Beijing exactly what it wanted. DeepSeek founders admitted that the chips control were his company's biggest constraint. As AI's compute demand soared, export controls allowed America's hardware advantage to deliver compounding benefits. Reversing course cedes those gains to China. Mr. Ginn's notion that each NVIDIA chip sent abroad is a new point on the board for American software and values, assume vendor lock-ins works in Leninist dictatorship as it does in free market democracies. The Chinese regime isn't a normal client. It's a rival with decades-old policy of replacing U.S. vendors with indigenous alternatives. Beijing's playbook should be obvious by now. It requires foreign vendors to surrender their trade secrets, then scales up domestic competitors and displaces foreign suppliers, first in China, then abroad. Xi Jinping was backing efforts to replace NVIDIA long before Washington moved to restrict its chip exports. Our permissiveness gets him one step closer to that goal. Ironically, soon after the White House approved selling H2Os to China, Beijing summoned NVIDIA for questioning about chip safety. Beijing surely has two goals in mind: signal to domestic companies that they ought to shun American technology as soon as possible, and manipulate NVIDIA to reveal how it designs its chips so that Chinese GPU makers can replace NVIDIA even faster. Mr. Ginn is also unfortunately shrugs off national security risks. This year, the People's Liberation Army sought H2O chips for military AI systems. We've seen this pattern before. U.S.-based Cadence Design Systems last month pleaded guilty to criminal violations of export controls and was fined $140 million after its semiconductor design technology diverted through Chinese entities powered PLA hypersonic missile simulations. Mr. Ginn, whose company is an NVIDIA partner, is right that America needs a strategy beyond export controls, including streamlined energy approvals and faster reindustrialization. But these initiatives would complement, not replace, export controls. By Matt Pottinger and Lisa Tobin. Retail. Inside Target, frustrated employees and the search for a new CEO. Target, needing to revive sales and boost morale, searches for its next leader. By Sarah Nassauer. Many Target shoppers are frustrated with the retailer. Many Target employees are too. In early June, a company-wide survey showed that roughly half of Target's employees didn't think the company was making the changes necessary to compete effectively. About 40% of the roughly 260,000 staffers who replied said they didn't have confidence in the company's future. The scores, which declined from a year ago, were even lower than those staffers at Target's headquarters in Minneapolis. The worker sentiment data reflects the challenges ahead for the company as it prepares to navigate a leadership change and turn around 10 quarters of flat or falling sales in an increasingly complex consumer environment. In an internal video on August 6, Chief Commercial Officer Rick Gomez acknowledged that the worker survey showed that we need to do a better job of empowering you to do your best work. He asked leaders to remove obstacles and simplify the way teams work. Target has lost its footing as shoppers turn to other retailers that are perceived to have lower prices at a time of high inflation and better selection or in-store experience, according to internal data and former and current executives. Target has also been ensnared in culture war issues surrounding its gay pride product selections and corporate diversity, equity, and inclusion policies. For more than 2 years, Chief Executive Brian Cornell has said the company would turn things around with a focus on unique products, good values, and improving fundamentals like better stocking its shelves. So far, the strategy hasn't produced much sales growth. Target reports its latest quarterly results August 20. While we recognize the hard work and progress underway, we're not where we want to be, Cornell said in a statement Saturday. Across the organization, we're focused on building on our strengths, said the CEO. Backed by strong assets, proven capabilities, and a talented team, we're confident in our path forward. Cornell, 66, is preparing to step aside as CEO after more than a decade in the role. In 2022, the board eliminated its mandatory retirement age of 65 and said Cornell had committed to stay approximately 3 more years. The board has been running a CEO succession process, and among the candidates is one of his top deputies, Michael Fidelke, the current chief operating officer, said people familiar with the situation. Fidelke, 49, has worked his way up the ranks since joining Target as a finance intern in 2003, including a 5-year stint as chief financial officer. Earlier this year, Fidelke was named to lead a new effort to improve operations. Longtime executive Christina Hennington, also considered a possible next CEO, left the company. Some investors prefer an outsider to take the helm. In a June survey sent to medium and large investors by Mizuho Securities, 96% of the 51 that responded said they would prefer an external candidate as Target's next CEO. Those investors are saying that Target has gone off the rails, basically, said David Bellinger, a senior research analyst with the firm. A way to promote wholesale change is to go with an external guy. The internal employee survey shows that our team is not happy with the current performance, said a Target spokesman, but the team wants to see Target succeed. About 80% of headquarter workers said they plan to stay with the company, he said. Target executives have said they are trying to bring back the momentum of Target's heyday, when it was known for fashionable, affordable items and partnerships with high-end designers. Executives have said some recent partnerships have driven sales, including an exclusive deal to sell a Taylor Swift book this past holiday season and a partnership with the Kate Spade brand this year. In a world where we operate today, our guests are looking for the Target, Cornell said at an investor meeting in March, using the nickname customers gave Target decades ago to describe its combination of trendy items and slightly elevated everyday goods. In the past, that formula worked well because it differentiated Target from larger competitors at the time, such as Kmart and Walmart, who were offering basic goods at low prices, said Bob Ulrich, who led Target as CEO from 1987 to 2008, a time of soaring sales for the retailer. We just built these fun, great things at a hell of a price, said Ulrich in an interview, and we had some really great marketing people. Today's environment is harder because more retailers have tried a similar approach, and Target has made some missteps, said Ulrich. I think people would celebrate if Target comes back and returns to shop if it got fixed, he said. Target is producing significant profit and investing that back into the business to create future growth, including $4 billion this year, said the Target spokesman. Target's digital business is profitable, and digital sales have tripled since 2019, he said. Shoppers' perception of why they should come to Target has eroded in recent years, according to internal data and executives. For example, even as Target invested to lower prices on thousands of items, shoppers perceive prices as higher than some competitors, and some of these people. Target's rebuke of gay pride merchandise in 2023 and some DEI policies earlier this year has hurt sales and angered some investors and workers. In January, Target said it would stop using the term DEI and wind down some diversity-focused programs as conservative activists and the Trump administration condemned the policies at companies broadly. Anne and Lucy Dayton, daughters of one of Target's founding families, wrote letters to the editors of national newspapers that said they were shocked and dismayed by the changes. The Dayton family has no involvement in the company. Organizers of Target's hometown Pride Parade banned the company as a sponsor this year in response. In May, Cornell said shoppers' backlash to the DEI announcement ate into its most recent quarterly sales, just as changes around its Pride collection in 2023 had hurt sales. The retailer has lost market share in categories it had long dominated, including apparel and home goods, according to estimates from investment firm Bernstein, which recommended investors sell the company's stock in May. For the next CEO, Target could benefit from a leader with broad merchandising, turnaround, and digital retail experience, Bernstein said in its report, adding, a steady hand and an ability to work under pressure will be required. Technology, NVIDIA, AMD to give U.S. 15% cut on AI chip sales to China. Unusual arrangement follows NVIDIA CEO Jensen Huang's meeting with Trump by Amrit Ramkumar and Robbie Whelan. NVIDIA and Advanced Micro Devices have agreed to give the Trump administration a portion of the sales from their artificial intelligence chips to China, unusual agreements that deepen their relationships with the U.S. government. The Trump administration will receive 15% of the sales as part of a deal to approve export of NVIDIA's H2O AI chipped to China, according to people familiar with the matter. That could amount to billions of dollars given demand for the H2O chips and is the latest example of the White House employing novel tactics to raise revenue. The administration has reached the same agreement with AMD for its MI308 chip, the people said. Details of arrangements and the financial structures are still being worked out. The Commerce Department began issuing licenses for NVIDIA to send its H2O chips to China Friday, following through on a July promise. Over the weekend, the agency started moving licenses for the AMD chip, some of the people familiar with the matter said. Exports of the H2O and MI308 were halted in April, when trade tensions between the U.S. and China were simmering. NVIDIA CEO Jensen Huang has gone on a charm offensive since then, talking to officials in both countries about the need to do business with one another. We follow rules the U.S. government sets for our participation in worldwide markets, NVIDIA said in a statement Sunday. While we haven't shipped H2O to China for months, we hope export control rules will let America compete in China and worldwide. The revenue agreement came after Wang met with President Trump on Wednesday. The same day, Trump announced tech companies that invest in the U.S. would be exempt from new chip tariffs. The Financial Times earlier reported on the agreements. It is unusual for companies to essentially pay for export licenses. The agreements follow criticisms from national security hawks who fear the chips and other technologies will boost China's AI ecosystems and military. NVIDIA has said its chips don't get diverted to U.S. adversaries in large quantities. Administration officials say the H2O isn't a top-performing chip and that they want NVIDIA to compete with China's Huawei around the world. The NVIDIA and AMD licenses are some of the only licenses being granted while the U.S. and China continue negotiating on trade. Access to semiconductors is one of the biggest priorities for the Chinese and advantages for the U.S. NVIDIA developed the H2O specifically for the Chinese market in 2023 after the Biden administration placed export restrictions on more advanced AI chips. The chip uses the company's Hopper architecture, which allows for tens of thousands of cores or processing units that can each handle simultaneous computations and is less powerful than NVIDIA's latest series known as Blackwell. The chip isn't advanced enough to quickly train large language AI models, but is useful for inference functions or the processes by which models that have already been trained can draw conclusions from new data. Chinese authorities have raised concerns about H2O chips, cautioning that they aren't environmentally friendly and could come with security risks. NVIDIA said this month that the chips don't have so-called backdoors that allow them to be controlled or accessed remotely. The Trump administration has made exporting U.S. AI to the rest of the world a top priority, hoping that American chip and model companies become the standard globally. Chinese models from companies such as DeepSeek and Alibaba are taking hold in many countries, increasing pressure on the U.S. to continue improving its capabilities in that area. China, the engineering marvel that China hopes will help wean it off foreign energy. A $167 billion power project promotes Chinese self-sufficiency while unsettling neighbors downstream. Hong Kong, China has begun the construction of a giant hydropower project at the earthquake-prone edge of the Tibetan Plateau, a spectacular engineering feat that is central to Beijing's enduring mission to become self-sufficient in critical areas such as energy. The $167 billion facility will require digging tunnels that plunge through high mountains to harness the power of a river that sharply descends through the deepest and possibly longest canyon on the planet. If its planners succeed after shrugging off objections from neighbors, the project could generate triple the output of the world's largest hydroelectric facility, China's Three Gorges Dam, which is big enough to power around 40 million Chinese homes. The endeavor is a dramatic example of China's determination to become self-reliant in areas of national importance, from technology to food, a years-long campaign that has gained momentum as Beijing's rivalry with the U.S. intensifies. China imported nearly a quarter of its energy supplies in 2023, a level of dependency that Beijing is working hard to undo. The plan, slated to be the world's most expensive infrastructure project, will also plow money into a struggling Chinese economy and bring jobs and businesses to a remote and sensitive corner of China where Beijing is trying to engineer the loyalty of the Tibetan population. A planned $7 billion high-voltage transmission network will deliver electricity from the site in Tibet to Guangdong Province, the economic center on China's southeast coast, and the cities of Hong Kong and Macau. But the project on the Yarlung Tsangpo River has stirred accusations that it will give Beijing the power to strangle resources beyond its borders, where the river flows into northeastern India and then south through Bangladesh. It has also raised fears of environmental damage and potential disaster in the mountainous, seismically active region. The location is one of vast biodiversity, featuring rare primates and a wider range of big cats, from snow leopards to Bengal tigers, than anywhere else in the world. China has yet to reveal the details, but it is evident that the design aims to avoid the pitfalls of some of the original plans, which include using nuclear explosions to blast a route north. "It's super clever," said Ruth Gamble, an environmental historian at La Trobe University in Australia, who studies Himalayan rivers. "I don't like dams, but as far as dams go, it avoids all the wrong stuff." The project achieves that because it likely won't rely on a mega dam to generate power. Instead, according to interviews, online postings by Chinese hydrologists, and a review of official statements, the project involves drilling deep tunnels that begin above and emerge below the Yarlung Tsangpo Grand Canyon, essentially cutting a U-shaped bend that descends nearly 2 vertical miles over more than 300 miles. It is expected to include dams at the top and bottom of tunnels in which diverted water drives turbines. Chinese Premier Li Qiang, inaugurating the project last month, called it a project of the century. Experts say it appears to emphasize run-of-the-river design, using the water's flow without relying on significant storage behind a dam. "This dam doesn't take the water out of the river," said Mark Giordano, a geography professor at Georgetown University. "It's a tunnel that reroutes it from one part of the Chinese river through the tunnels and enters the river again on the Chinese side before flowing to India." The bigger issue for China and its downstream neighbors could be the dam's location in an area with a history of huge earthquakes. In 1950, a magnitude 8.6 earthquake centered about 50 miles northwest of where the Yarlung Tsangpo enters India struck the region, killing more than 4,500 people and setting off hundreds of landslides, including some that blocked rivers. "It's a high earthquake zone, so that's clearly a risk," said Giordano. China has carried out extensive hydropower projects in recent decades in an effort to boost its supply of renewable energy. The Three Gorges Dam, which was completed in 2006, created a 400-mile reservoir on the Yangtze River and forced the relocation of 1.3 million people. Where the Three Gorges Dam aroused skepticism even within China's rubber stamp legislature, the Yarlung Tsangpo project has met with far less resistance, a sign of Beijing's growing confidence in hydropower construction and its ability to quash even nominal dissent. But news of the project had prompted protests from across the border. Pema Khandu, chief minister of the neighboring Indian state of Arunachal Pradesh, has called it a water bomb that poses an existential threat to his constituents because untimely releases of water could exacerbate seasonal flooding. India has responded with plans to build a mega dam on the river, in part to control the flow. Adding to tensions, Beijing claims Arunachal Pradesh as its own territory, referring to it as Southern Tibet. The relationship between China and India has been strained by territorial disputes, including a deadly military clash in 2020. China, India, and Bangladesh have no agreement for managing the river, which becomes the Brahmaputra in India and eventually joins the Ganges in Bangladesh. China has rejected criticism from states downriver, which say they could suffer from changes in the flow of water and sediment. The project will speed up to clean energy development, improve local people's lives, and proactively respond to climate change, said Gao Jiakun, a spokesman for China's Ministry of Foreign Affairs. To the east of the Yarlung Tsangpo, where Tibet meets Sichuan Province, China is already building a series of dams along the upper reaches of the Yangtze, the country's longest river. More than a dozen dams are planned for the section of the river known as the Jinsu, which is now the site of the world's second largest and fourth largest dams by installed capacity. The Yarlung Tsangpo has been comparatively untouched. A group of Chinese hydrologists estimated in 2022 that the river was generating just 2% of its potential hydropower capacity. Exiled Tibetans in India say they also have concerns about the work being done in their homeland, and some projects have prompted protests, including the Yabetan Dam on the upper Jingsa, which Tibetans protested last year because some villages and historic monasteries would be inundated. When disaster happens, it's the local Tibetans that face the consequences, said Lobsang Yangso, an environmental researcher with the International Tibet Network based in India. And that's all we have time for today. That brings us to the end of today's edition of the Wall Street Journal. I'm Cicely Tiernan, your volunteer broadcaster on Sun Sounds of Arizona. Stay tuned for more interesting programming on Sun Sounds.